Hello.
My name is Poppy Carver Kay, and I'm 19 years old. And today I am here with
her dad.
You have to do the name and age.
My name is Thomas Richard Carver. And I don't have to say my age. God, I'm ancient. I'm 64.
Yes. Okay, and we have a set of questions today for the father. Okay, well, do you want hard or easiest? Should we do fun first?
Okay.
First question is, what's your craziest story?
My craziest story of my life.
Of your life, yes.
My craziest story of my life. I was once taken hostage in Somalia because I was a journalist, and we had to go down to this town in the south called Baidira, and when the only way we could get down there was by car, and there were no car hire companies in Somalia, so we went to this local warlord and asked if we could borrow his car. And he said, yeah, okay. Not quite like that, but he did say yes. And then he lent us his son to drive it, which we thought was very nice of him. So we went down to this place, and the first time we drive through this town, we see all these people waving at us, and we think, that's so nice. They're waving at us, they're happy to see us. And then we went out and did some filming, and then we came back later the day through the town, and they were waving their fists at us. I thought it was a bit odd. And then the third time we came through the town, they ran after us. And they had these long knives, like kind of between a sword and a knife. And we were in this Land Cruiser, and they started stabbing the Land Cruiser through the door of the Land Cruiser with these weapons. And the driver, who was the son, panicked and kind of took a wrong turn and ended up in this dead end. And so we were surrounded, and so we had to get out of the car. There were everyone yelling at us, and they tried to take the son and kill him. This is quite serious already, isn't it? But
yeah.
But anyway, you asked me for a crazy story, and we managed to save him, and we took him away, and long story short, we got hold of some American Marines who were very nice and gave us a lift back on their plane to the capital, Mogadishu. And so we go to this warlord and we say, Mr. Warlord, I forget his name, we have, I'm afraid, lost your car, because they took the car, but we did save the life of your son. And you know what he said? He said, I have 7 sons, but only 1 car. Which is like such a freaky, incredible, mind-blowing thing to say. And he didn't show in the least bit regard for his son. And so he said, well, never mind, but we'll pay you for your car. I'm really sorry. It was a beaten up old Land Cruiser. How much do you want? He said, I'd like $250,000. And we started laughing because it was like worth about $1,000. And we said, well, we can't pay that. We haven't got that much money. And so every day he came to where we were staying with his mates with these guns and just put these guns to our head and said, you don't pay. You've got to pay by tomorrow. You've got to pay. So we started negotiating with him, and we bring him down slowly by, 250, down to 200, down to 150, down to 100. And we get down to $50,000. And that was as far as he was prepared to go. And at that stage, it was Christmas Eve. And so I have to call up the BBC in London and tell them that I need $50,000. And also what made it worse was that he wanted it in used notes. He wasn't going to, there was no bank in Somalia. So he wanted it in used notes that were printed no later than 1990 or something, because he thought all notes after that were forgeries. And so this poor kid in the desk in London was sent to run around the banks in the city of London getting this money and making sure that the notes were no later than 1990. And then he put them into a suitcase, and he had the suitcase handcuffed to his hand, and he was put on a plane out to Somalia. He must have been like, I don't know, 21 or something. I mean, he was really young. Poor guy, he's probably just an intern. And he ends up in Somalia, and he's as white as a sheet. And we meet him on the runway, and he just like quickly undoes the suitcase, gives it to us, and jumps back in the plane as fast as he can. And so we got the money on Christmas Day, and we went and gave it to the Somali warlord, and we went off and got drunk.
Okay.
My closest brush with death up to that point.
Okay, well, that was a pretty crazy story. So we're going to move it on to something a bit more casual. The next question is something you're looking forward to.
I'm looking forward to seeing you graduate. Okay. How about that?
That's in a while.
Oh, you mean immediately looking forward to? Oh, anything. I'm looking forward to breakfast. I love breakfast. I mean, I just like think of breakfast. Before I go to bed, I think of breakfast, which I know is really weird. But I like breakfast. It's like happy time of day. It's like the beginning of the day. I'm looking for my coffee. Think of all the things I could have for breakfast. Of course, I never have any of them. You know, I think about, I could have kedgeree or something.
Okay, swiftly moving on. Can I just say that actually breakfast is probably my least favorite part of the day. I don't like the mornings. Okay, yeah. But maybe the younger you are, the less you like the morning. Doing this
term? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I like the idea of the mornings.
Yeah, I get that.
I mean, imagine, you know, getting up before dawn or something. Wouldn't that be exciting?
That does sound
I never do it, but it would be kind of nice.
I'm scared that we're... Okay, this is definitely recording. I hope it's recording. It is recording, right? Okay. This is... The next question is... What is a piece of advice or a way of life that you realized later on?
Gosh, they're two quite different things. A piece of advice, I think that what I realized when I was quite young, actually, and I'm glad that I did realize it, is quite corny, but a thing of seize the day. And I do think when I was young, that was a big driving. I really wanted to just experience everything and travel and see everything. And I was worried that somehow my life was going to get cut short in some way and I wasn't going to be able to see all those things. And now I'm, you know, old fart. and I don't do those exciting things anymore. But I'm really glad that I have done them and that they're part of my memory bank and that they're part of me. And like, you know, I sometimes think of an old oak tree that I had when I was growing up in England, and the oak tree had grown into this fence and the fence was like embedded into the oak tree. And I feel like that's sometimes like experiences, is that like it's there embedded in you as part of as you grow. So I think that's, I don't know, I mean, I'm not giving that advice to anyone else, it's just helped me.
Yeah, it's a good piece of advice. Okay, next question. Maybe I'll save that one for later. Oops.
She's got lots of little sticky things here.
Yeah, I should have written these down in my notebook.
She's doing the interview on her headphones, which is kind of interesting. So I hope everyone can hear this.
I know, I'm a bit scared that it's actually not recording, but I think that it is. Okay, this is quite sad. This is the saddest question of the mix. Okay. But I feel like it's quite nice after Seize the Day.
Okay.
Okay. It's a part, it's a threefold.
You know, as a journalist, we're only allowed to ask one thing.
Okay, but this is...
ask a kind of threefold question.
Okay, but this is a podcast. Okay. What was the hardest thing you've been through? How did it make you feel? And how do you feel about it now?
You mean apart from having been held hostage in Somalia?
Yes.
Okay. Hardest things are always the emotional things, right? Not so much the physical things. I mean, one of the most difficult things I ever did was to get divorced, which I'm not encouraging anyone to get divorced. I'm just saying that it took quite a lot of courage for me to do it because my parents really didn't approve. Well, my dad, my mum wasn't alive, but my dad really didn't approve of it because he was very Christian. And my family didn't approve. I'm one of six children. And none of them had got divorced. They were all older than me. And so I felt really kind of shameful, I suppose, in a way, that I was doing this and kind of somehow letting everyone down. And yet I knew morally it was the right thing to do, because otherwise it would just lead to years of unhappiness between me and my wife. So better to stop it kind of early on. So, yeah, it was hard to do. She didn't want to get divorced, and but I do think it was the right thing to do. I don't know if she, I've never asked her since if she thinks it was the right thing to do, but from my point of view it was, yeah. Not that I kind of think divorce is a great thing, but I just think getting out of something which you realize is a mistake takes a bit of emotional courage, and the easier thing to do is not to do that, and so, you know, that was quite hard to do. That makes sense.
And how do you feel about it now?
Oh,
how do I?
He just looked at the questions.
It's like they're all being dropped on the floor.
And how do you feel about it?
How do I feel about it now? I feel fine. I mean, it was like donkey's years ago.
But the emotions of it. Do you think there's still some part of you that feels a bit traumatized from it, or do you think you look at it in a completely rational way now?
Do you know, actually, I've just realized I've missed a whole thing, which is that, you know, I was sent to school at 7. That was one of the hardest things I ever had to do, by the way. But anyway, moving on.
This is what he speaks about every day. This is actually his daily trauma, I have to say.
I do not speak about that. It's every day. But how many people do you know that had that happen to them? And it was pretty awful school. But talking about things that had a lasting impact. No, I don't think my divorce had a lasting impact, really. No, I think I moved on pretty quickly. I mean, at the time I went a bit loopy for a few years afterwards, but now it was like this is 20 odd years ago. I don't think about it very much. No, and in fact I follow my ex-wife on Twitter just to see what she's up to. She has a big Twitter following, but that's my only contact I have with her.
Okay,
she's
well.
A good steer.
Yeah. Well, maybe she's listening to this, but I don't think that she is. Okay. What, this is also a twofold question. Sorry. What is, and honestly, they're two very separate questions. So I don't know why they're on the same sticky note. But it's kind of two in one. What is the thing you're proudest of, and what brings you most joy?
Well, what brings me most joy are my children. That's very clear, I think. One of whom seems to be asking me questions at the moment. because I do think that's a kind of very unexpected pleasure in life, and I wasn't necessarily expecting to have children, and I have them, and it's, yes, makes you feel complete in a way, I suppose, as a human, because it's probably a natural part of the cycle to, I mean, whether you adopt or whether you have them biologically, I don't think it really matters. It's but bringing up children, I think. And we were just talking earlier about my godchild who's 6 and how interesting he is. And, you know, I don't have a 6-year-old anymore. And so it made me kind of realize how amazing it is to raise a child, really. And it's a big responsibility. What was the first question?
What are you proudest of?
Oh, my proudest of. I'm proudest of. I mean, I think I'm a, you know, reasonable dad connected to the first question, and I'm quite proud of that. because you know you don't get any kind of you don't get a class to learn about being a dad, so you have to kind of learn on the job. And particularly if you know, everyone right has kind of issues with their own parents, and so how do you overcome those and try and be better than they were? And so I think that actually I'm quite proud of, because I think I'm a better dad than my dad was to me. He sent me off to school at 7. I don't know if I ever said that, but you know, anyway. yeah, so I'm quite proud of that. I'm proud of some of the reporting I did, but that's, you know, that's work really. I wrote a book about my dad actually, which I'm quite proud of as a book. I think it's quite well written book. Yeah, I mean, there's kind of, you know, there's some moments in my career, but honestly, what I've done in my work does kind of pale into, not insignificance, but it's not as important. I mean, if you said, do you choose between the achievements of your work and the achievements of being a human being and being a parent, I'd always choose the latter, because I think that's what, you know, when you're on your deathbed, you're probably not thinking about your work. You're probably thinking about your family, and that's what lasts with you.
Yeah, I agree with that, even though I don't have children. Okay, let's see. One of them I just think that you're not going to be able to answer.
Was what?
One of these questions I think you're not going to be able to answer.
Do I get a pass on anything?
Well, it's not a difficult question. I just don't think that you are going to be able to answer it. Okay. The question is, what is your favorite poem?
Oh.
What my no, I can't answer that. Why? Because you think I don't know any poetry, isn't that what you're saying?
Or just maybe not off the top of your head.
Well, this is it's a bit morbid, but Dulce Decorum Est by Wilfred Owen, I think is one of my most memorable poems.
Do you remember reading it for the first time?
Yes, I do. Yeah, and in fact, I can visualize the book. It's like red. I think I gave it to you actually. In an anthology of First World War poets. I remember reading it when I was, for English A-level, and just being kind of blown away because it was so visceral. You know, most poetry I'd read up to that point was rather abstract and kind of about emotions in a kind of abstract sort of way, like the Romantics and Tennyson and Shakespeare and things. But this was like real, you know, guts and visceral sense of dying and a visceral sense of what it felt like, you know, touch, and I'd never encountered that in a poem before, you know, the senses. The other poem I would say that had a big effect on me is Under Milk Wood by Dylan Thomas. I remember reading that for the first time and just the kind of elasticity of the language and the way in which he plays with the language, and because he's, you know, spoke Welsh as well as English, he's kind of, you know, has this sort of loose connect relationship with English language, which makes it so incredible. So yeah, those are probably two that come to mind. I'm not sure that they're the very best poems I've ever read, but there was two that were very memorable.
Okay. I didn't think that you'd be able to answer that question, actually. Oh, this is a nice question. What is the kindest thing somebody has done or said to you?
Gosh, that's a really hard question.
Oh, really?
Well, to think of the very kindest thing that someone has ever done. Oh, I think this is not good. This kind of, you know, not probably much surprise, but my mum died when I was 24, I guess. Which, you know, is obviously I was an adult, so I didn't lose her in childhood, but it is kind of amazing when you get to my age how little of my life I had with her. And I have a very visceral memory of a bike ride I took with her when I was probably 12, and her explicitly turning round to me and telling me that she loved me. And I think that was the first time anyone that I can remember has ever explicitly told me, you know, I mean, people kind of give you hugs and things, but to actually kind of say it purposefully and intentionally and to stop the bike. And, you know, I can remember the field we were in. and it really kind of penetrated, I guess, and it was, you know, it's been, I mean, to have that lodged, like, you know, the bit of barbed wire in the oak tree, you know, to have that lodged in you as you grow up and grow old is really useful, because, you know, you kind of think when times are tough that someone at some stage in life really loved you.
That is very
just
kind.
Moving this white thing back and forward.
Because you keep hesitating. I don't know if you're done speaking. That is very kind thing to say. Quite a nice story. Okay. Okay. Next question is, this is the second to last question, unfortunately.
Have you gone through all those ones over there?
Yeah, which means maybe you haven't been answering them in enough detail.
No, I didn't. That's fine.
Yeah. Okay, this question is, what do you believe in? This is the one I told you about in the restaurant.
Well, I don't think that stays steady with you in your life. You don't always, I don't think you should always believe the same thing throughout your life. Because otherwise, I don't think you're growing, really. I do think it's important to come from a point of departure. And so my point of departure was, you know, growing up as a kind of traditional Christian. And I tried to explore things from there. And so where am I at now? Well, I don't know, actually. I mean, I said to you in the restaurant that I feel I've lapsed in my attention to my spiritual side, probably. And that is actually quite an interesting thing, is that why do we go through ups and downs in feeling spiritual or religious? You know, why isn't it a constant? I mean, I suppose some people are constant about it, but is it because actually you have it when you feel need of it, you know, difficult times of your life? And then when you're feeling okay, it kind of diminishes and goes into the background. So at this stage of my life, I don't know what I believe in. I mean, I definitely believe the Jewish faith, as you know, has this intriguing idea that there's not really an afterlife. And that's, you know, one theory why Jewish people are so incredibly successful in so many fields, in art and culture and science and so forth, because they give up everything to this life. I don't think I believe that. I think there is something of an afterlife, and I'm not at the extreme end where I think that's more important than this life, but I also don't think this life's the only life. And so I quite like the Buddhist idea of kind of going back into the universal consciousness and becoming kind of just part of a kind of huge corporate, not a corporate, but a huge body of consciousness. I find myself thinking about death more, and I find it intriguing. When my mum died, partly because she was having a very painful cancer, but she also had a very strong faith, and she was kind of looking forward to it, I think, and that really puzzled me when I was 24. You know, I couldn't understand why someone could be so at peace with the idea of dying. I hope I'll be like that and not kind of terrified of, you know, and raging against the darkness, sort of thing. As Dylan Thomas said, dying of the light. I think I do believe that there is some afterlife. I definitely believe that there's a consciousness that connects us to the universe in some way that I can't possibly understand, but I think it's there. I don't think we're just like atoms bouncing around. Your sister, as you know, is a very strong astrophysicist, and so she has a firm sense that we are just atoms bouncing around in this space. Mm. And I find that difficult to comprehend, or kind of bleak, I suppose. I guess that's what I believe. It's kind of wishy-washy, right? But you know, you don't have very hard to have really firm beliefs in the spiritual sense. But maybe you meant belief in another sense.
Well, I think it's however you want to answer the question. But I actually have a follow-up question that wasn't on the sticky note, but I'm quite intrigued. What's the most spiritual experience that you've ever had?
Well, when I was young, you know, when I was like 12, 13, that was my most intense kind of Christian phase. I really thought I was close to God at times. I went to a very religious school, and we would go, you know, often to church, and I really enjoyed it. And maybe because I was quite unhappy at the school, it was like a salvation for me to be able to talk to God. And there was, and so the kind of books I read at the time, I read quite a lot of religious books, C.S. Lewis I read a lot of, and still, you know, he's obviously a brilliant theologian. There was a guy called Pastor Wurmbrandt who was tortured by the Nazis and survived and had an incredible Christian faith. And so I would read his books, you know, kind of the idea of theology under duress or under massive stress. But recently, I mean, I, as you know, I took psilocybin, and that gave me a very profound spiritual experience, I think, because it did make me feel this sense of connectedness to the world and to kind of a greater consciousness, and to my mother, who, you know, died a long time ago. And, you know, I think there is probably a chemical explanation for that, that, you know, what that does to the brain and how that operates in the brain. But then there is also a dimension of, you know, just in the way that chemistry can't really explain what the mind is. It can explain what the brain is, but it can't explain what the mind is. And I think that's also, it can't explain those sort of spiritual feelings that, that the mind or the soul is capable of generating. So, you know, that for me, it was triggered by psilocybin, but why did it come? Why did it happen? Why did that happen and not something else happen when I took the psilocybin? And so it was a very spiritual experience, although I was at this retreat and it was like 8 hours, you know, we were on our trip, there was like 20 of us, and I kind of sat up at the end of it and had this amazing experience. And the lady next to me, I said to her, you know, how is that for you? And she said, I didn't feel anything at all. I felt so, and she was so cross, and I felt so sad for her. And, you know, and so maybe that is a chemical thing, that is a chemical just didn't work for her brain. I don't know.
Interesting. I was speaking to a friend the other day who said that she took mushrooms and she also didn't feel anything. So maybe for some people it just doesn't work.
But they talk about set and setting. So set being the mindset. You've got to go in and have the right mindset to be able to open your mind to it. Otherwise you might not feel anything. And then if you're not in the right setting, if you're, you know, at some party or a techno rave or whatever and you're taking it, that might also contribute to not experiencing it properly. So, you know, it's not just that some people do and some people don't. It's whether you're in the right set and setting.
Okay. And on a more grounded level, to round off this question, and then we'll get to the next question. I wonder what you, not to say that you answered this question wrong by any means, but I wonder what you believe.
There's no wrong answer,
yeah. Exactly. And talking about mushrooms is okay. But I wonder what you believe in this, like, lifetime. Like, what, not morals, but what you believe is important to you today in the way, in order to succeed in the way that you want to lead your life.
To me or to the society?
Well, you would think kind of that they would translate or transfer.
Well, no, because I have control over myself. So there are ways that I can live. But obviously I don't have control over the government or how a society is formed. I mean, I think I think it's, you know, what do I believe in? I mean, I believe in all the traditional morals. I think that, I mean, just to kind of take it back to what I said about my mom, I think it's very important, I believe that it's very important to express love, and actually to express all emotion within reason, you know. I mean, one shouldn't obviously say everything that one feels all the time with no filter, because that could be challenging. But I think if you do feel love for someone, it's amazing how rarely I think people really get told that, you know. And as long as it's really genuine and comes from a really genuine place, and I think that obviously makes a huge difference to people's lives, as it did to my life. So I think that's very important. I think I tell you, as I've got older, that I've come to believe in, which might not be very revolutionary, but it kind of applies at a societal level as well, which is just live and let live. I think I used to, when I was young, have very strong views about how things should be done and how things should be lived, and what I'm kind of pleased about, I suppose, is that often you see people getting older and they get more intolerant, and I think actually I've got more tolerant of people. I think I've become more tolerant of different peoples and different approaches, and I think that's important. I think that's, you know, as you get older, there is a risk that you just kind of descend into your own little narrow views of life and think that you know best, and the younger generation or whatever, or a different generation, don't know anything. And actually I think for me, the longer I've gone on in life, I feel like the less I know, you know, the more there is to learn from others.
Okay, and the last question is, what are your three favorite books?
I don't think you can. Do you mean favorite by, like, if I was stranded on a desert island, those would be the books I take? Or, because that's would be a different answer. Or what are three books that had a big impact on me? Or what would you mean by favorite? Do you mean if I only had three books, those would be the only books? Or do you want just three books that had a big impact on me?
I think three books, those would be the only books. Because maybe every book kind of has an impact on someone. Do you know what I mean? Whereas, like, I think the three books that you would take...
Yeah, but the three books you'd take to survive on a desert island wouldn't necessarily be my favourites, right? I'd take books that would be incredibly challenging, because obviously I'm going to be on this freaking island for a while. So, you know, how do you, you know... I'd probably take Kierkegaard or something.
Okay, you complicated this question a lot. But what I mean is that I don't want those... If I say these three books that had an impact on you... And I don't want them to be just like books you've read recently that you thought were quite good.
Books that had an unexpected impact, maybe.
Or not even unexpected. I mean, if you said Crime and Punishment had a really amazing impact on you, so be it. But do you know what I mean?
So
just not recent.
I know, okay. I mean, so when I was like 12, I read this book, which I think is by an American author, actually, called My Side of the Mountain. And I remember getting it for my son, and he had no interest in it. And I was really
when sad. You were, how old were you?
12.
But your son didn't?
No, so when I had a son,
okay,
and he was 12, I remember going out and finding this book and giving it to him, and he you know, went there, whatever. But when I was 12, it had a huge impact on me, and it was about this boy who basically runs away from home. He's living, I think he must have been living in Appalachia or something, but anyway, when I was 12, I had no idea where he was living, but he was living in the mountains somewhere, and he ran away from home, and he makes a house in this tree on the other side of this mountain, and he just lives in nature as this boy on his own, and he has a hunting falcon, a bird that hunts with, and he lays traps, and he builds this bed made out of grass, and he starts to cultivate the berries, and I just thought that's incredible, you know, that's kind of, and that's had a very profound effect on me, because I've always thought not that I've ever really gone out and done that, but it just the way of living close to nature, that really made me feel about nature, opened my eyes to nature in a way that has always stayed with me. And then at another extreme would be as a book, I guess no one reads it now, but was huge for a while, called Gormenghast, which is this extraordinary kind of trilogy, kind of dark gothic, but very readable trilogy about this kind of make-believe castle called Gormenghast and these characters that live in it, written by a guy called Mervyn Peake. And it was written in the 1960s, I guess, and it's a slightly kind of alternative, but incredibly well written. And I just completely devoured that. I kind of lived in this castle with these characters and kind of felt, yeah, I mean, that's kind of one of those books that where you really live inside it and not just with it. And then, well, you know, I mean, I'd say The Leopard, I've mentioned The Leopard to you, and I know you didn't think much of it, but it's an amazing, evocative book about this kind of family in decline in Sicily in the 19th century. And I think it's recognized now as one of the great Italian novels. And in fact, there's a series that's just come out about it on TV, which is not very good, because but what it misses is this mysticism in the book, this kind of magic thing. So like he's sitting in the chapel and he's bored and all the cherubs, the paintings on the walls start talking to him. So there's a kind of magic realism about it. But it's about basically this family that was once very powerful and ruled the whole of Sicily, and how times change and so, and the family can't adapt and they get left behind. And that has always had a big impact on me, maybe because I come from Britain and Britain is full of kind of stories like that, where they were once huge rulers of the world and now, you know, whatever, 5% of the world's GDP. So, but I think that always interests me, about how do families, I mean, like the Medicis, you know, who's the Medici now? Medicis once ruled Florence, but, you know, no one who's called a Medici has any power today. That's kind of interesting how power and attention moves from one family to another over time.
Okay. Well, that was it. Do you have any final
questions for you?
Yeah, any questions for me or final remarks? I really hope that this is like, I've been stressed this whole time that I'm going to listen back and it's going to be all muffled or something, but I think it's going to be okay, right?
Okay, I'm just for the record, I'm not doing this again.
That's why I'm scared. Okay.
This is going to be like a bootleg recording that people will discover in years to come. Do you have any questions? I mean, are you going to improve your recording equipment? Could be one, if you're going to carry on doing this.
I actually quite like this. I think it's easier.
You certainly have to get very close to your interviewee.
And your arm kind of cramps and then moving back and forth.
Holding it up.
Yeah.
Do you... I don't have any other questions. I mean, I'm looking forward to listening to the others.
You have no questions for me?
Well, I do have a lot of questions, but then, you know, I don't think that's the appropriate time to ask, really. I mean, we could ask all those questions of you.
No, that's okay. What was your favorite question? What was the most thought-provoking question?
The most difficult question is, what do you believe in? Mm-hmm. I think that's really difficult. But it makes me think I should be able to answer it.
What was your favorite question?
My favorite question.
The most fun, or just like the kindness?
Yeah, I thought they were really good. I think the kindness question is really interesting. Mm. I'm glad you didn't ask me, you know, what was the worst thing. That would have been helpful.
What?
The most unkind thing anyone's ever said. That would have been terrible, right? How did you come up with these questions, I guess, is a question I have, because they're kind of interesting. And now are you going to ask these same questions to everyone?
No. Because they think these are quite wise questions. Not to make any inference about the age. But I think last night I was reading this book that I was thinking about, O. William. And I was in bed. And I just thought about how I was going to see you. And then I thought about my podcast. And then I just kind of wrote them. They just kind of came up. I didn't really think particularly hard about them. But maybe now I think that maybe I should have thought.
But maybe they're a reflection of you. Maybe those questions are what motivates you.
Yeah, probably.
Kindness.
Belief. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is probably why. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's probably true. Probably a reflection of me. And probably a reflection of what I think our relationship is based on, maybe. Things that we would both find interesting to talk about.
Mm. Books.
Certainly. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Well, I'm going to end this and hope that it's recorded correctly. So should I just end it? Should we say bye? What? Who are we saying bye to? It's just us in this
mass audience. Goodbye. Good night.
Good night. Goodbye. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to end it. I think it's quite an awkward ending. Now it's too late to end it. Okay, you need to have the final word because it's so awkward for me to end this now.
Dulce et decorum est per patria mori.